Hello, Les Raymond here with the Mindful Movement. Whether you are about to enjoy one of Sarah's beautiful meditations or dive into a podcast interview, I would like to remind our community that the best way to support the Mindful Movement is to support the companies that make this happen. Sarah and I are very picky about the companies we choose to work with, and we are grateful to have the relationships we have and to share them with our listeners. You can learn more about our affiliates through our website by clicking on the Favorites tab. We are excited to have recently added Sun Lighten as an affiliate. They make state-of-the-art infrared saunas, and their founder, Connie, came on for a recent interview if you would like to listen. Our Sun Lighten sauna has been a family favorite for over a decade. Some of our most popular affiliates are the Grounding Mats from Ultimate Longevity, which we sleep on every night, and the Apollo Neuro, which Sarah is now wearing daily to help manage stress. When you support these brands, you in turn are supporting the Mindful Movement and helping Sarah and I continue to devote our time to this passion. Whether you check out these companies or not, I just want to say thanks again and reiterate how grateful Sarah and I both are for all of the support over the years. I hope you enjoy the episode.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Mindful Movement Podcast. I'm your host, Les Raymond. Thanks for tuning in today for another episode. Grateful to have Dr. Glenn Livingston on the podcast today. Glenn, thanks for joining me.
Grateful to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
You have a website, Never Binge Again.
That's actually the old one.
Oh, that's the old one. Okay.
Yeah, that's the old book. Has a million readers and whatever. But the newest book has the benefit of 8 years and 2,000 clients of experience and all their latest scientific research. It's called Defeat Your Cravings. Defeat Your Cravings. That's the one to read.
Okay. What's the big deal with craving or binging? I like binging. It can be fun. What's the big deal, man?
Oh, well, it's not for me to tell you to change your behavior if you don't want to. And I believe that we fought wars for our freedom in this country, and part of that includes the freedom to eat mass quantities of chocolate or Doritos or anything that you really want to have. It's the problem is when people eat beyond their own best judgment and hate themselves for it, or if they're suffering medical consequences, or are not satisfied with their energy level or their presence of mind. Usually binging and mindfulness are difficult to maintain in the same space. Sorry, I tell people if you want to eat 5,000 calories of potato chips, then by all means, feel free to do that. But probably it'll work out better for you if you plan out exactly how and when you want to do that and how you're going to recover from it. And it's not something that I choose to do anymore. I had a big problem a long time ago, but yeah, no judgments. I don't think it will keep you out of heaven. But, I'm here to help if you would like to, you'd like to stop or get more control.
So you access through your nutritional or health coaching, you really take an angle of working with the craving itself. What brought you to that? What's the backstory behind your journey that led you to focus on managing or defeating the cravings?
Well, I'd like to say that I lost the war with a chocolate bar in 1982, and it took me 20 years to wake up. Just about anything that wasn't nailed down. I was almost 300 pounds, and my triglycerides were over 1,000, and the doctors were yelling at me that I was going to die before I was 40. And, I'm 6'4". I'm genetically lucky. I'm kind of broad-shouldered and modestly muscular without doing much about it. So when I was a kid, if I worked out for a couple hours a day, I could eat whatever I wanted. And I mean, whatever I wanted, and I would stay thin. But I developed some bad habits. And, when I was a little older and I was married and I was commuting a few hours each way to go to graduate school and see patients, and then I came home and I'd be running our business and you know, talking to my ex-wife, my wife at the time, I didn't have 2 minutes a day to work out. And that's when it started to catch up to me a little bit. But what I found was that I was incapable of making the adjustment. It's like the food had a hold on me, and it had a hold on my thinking. I would be, you know, sitting with a suicidal client, and thankfully I never lost anyone, but I'd be thinking, when can I get the next pizza? You know, and I couldn't really lend them my soul in the way you really have to get people better. Because psychology is a lot more about getting people to love and trust you enough that they're willing to think new thoughts and try new things and step out of their comfort zone, much more so than having a lot of book knowledge and solving the jigsaw puzzle of their life and showing them that this piece goes over here and this piece goes over there. And then, thanks, doc, I'll get right on that. You know, it just doesn't really work like that. You got to be there with them. You got to go through it with them. And that bothered me more than the weight itself. That was a problem for me more than the weight initially. But my journey coming from a family of 17 psychologists and psychotherapists, where if something breaks in the house, we all ask it how it feels and nobody knows how to fix it. coming from that kind of a family, I really thought, you know, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so I must have a hole in my heart. And if I could figure out how to fill that hole in my heart, then I wouldn't have to keep trying to fill the hole in my stomach. And, you know, let me try to love myself then. And I literally went on this 20-year journey where I went to see the best psychotherapists and psychologists and psychiatrists, and I took medication, and I went to Overeaters Anonymous, and I, you know, went on a spiritual journey, and I did everything you could imagine. I confessed my soul, and I cried, and I screamed, and it made me a better person in a lot of ways. It took away a lot of the self-hatred that I had, made me feel more compassionate for myself and other people. But I, you know, so I don't regret the journey, but it didn't really help me with the food. I would go a little thinner, a lot fatter, a little thinner, a lot fatter every time I tried something new. And, you know, kind of speeding things up over the course of 20 years, there were three things that made me change that paradigm. I eventually come to the conclusion that I had to take a different approach. And one of them was that I had a lot of time on my hands because my wife at the time was traveling for business. I saw her mostly on the weekends. And so I developed a second career as a consultant to industry. And I was on the wrong side of the war. And I was helping to manufacture those bags and boxes and containers. And I feel contrite about it now, kind of like the Marlboro man later in his life. I'm trying to make up for it and kind of convince the world to move away from that. But, you know, I worked with a lot of these big companies that were manufacturing these hyper-palatable concentrations of starch and sugar and fat and excitotoxins and salt. And it was all geared towards hitting the bliss point in the reptilian brain without giving in the nutrition to feel satisfied. And the result of that is you want more and more and more. And there were things in the packaging that could turn off your ability to know when you were hungry or full. And it was all an external force, right? It all hit the lizard brain, and it didn't matter whether my mama dropped me in my head when I was a little boy, or her mama dropped her in her head, or, you know, I was traumatized by this, or I peeked at my sister, or what. None of that mattered. This was this external force that's targeting this very primitive part of my brain, and I'm representing the brainstem, and this primitive part of my brain is really a survival mechanism. It's eat, mate, or kill. Feast or famine, fight or flee. Very, very primitive survival impulses. It doesn't know love. It's the mammalian brain on top of that, and the neocortex on top of that, that says, before you eat, mate, or kill that thing, what impact is that going to have on the people that you love, on your tribe, on your family? And it's the neocortex that says, well, before you eat, mate, or kill that thing, what impact will that have on your work, on society, and your long-term goals like health and fitness and weight loss or mindfulness? And this thing down here doesn't really know love. So all this time, it struck me that I'm trying to love myself thin when the part of the brain that's responsible for pushing our reason out of the way and saying, you know, just hand over the chocolate and nobody gets hurt. This part of the brain is what's responsible for food problems. And so that gave me a perspective that maybe I had this love yourself thin thing wasn't going to work. I also saw the big advertising industry, because that's what I did largely, was advertising consulting. And I saw how they were experts at convincing us that what they had was what we needed. This is what we needed for survival. And there were things like setting up the packaging to be vibrant and multicolored and diverse. Because in nature, if you ran across a diversity of bright colors with fruits and vegetables, you'd be getting a diversity of nutrients. And so we have a variety impulse, was where we're kind of evolutionarily programmed to seek that survival advantage of getting a variety of nutrients. That's why we're supposed to eat the rainbow. But in this case, there were no vitamins. I mean, they actually took some of the vitamins out of the bar to put more money in the packaging. And, you know, they were faking us out. And that kind of thing was not constrained to one or two manufacturers. This went on all across the industry. There was something called plausible deniability, where, you know, these potato chips are made with avocado oil and therefore they're good for you, right? There'd be a big star now with avocado oil. But does anybody really think that there's a lot of nutrition in potato chips? Does anybody really think the potato chip is good for you? There's a big difference between something being less bad for you and something being good for you. But I saw how all the consumer's rational mind needed was plausible deniability, just a good enough reason to justify that it could eat a couple of bags of potato chips.
Can I pause you for a second and back mm-hmm. up on something you said? Mm-hmm. I want to hear about that, the plausible deniability. When you were talking about hyper palatable, and you mentioned mixing like starches and sugars with fat and I think maybe salt, you mentioned excitotoxins. Mm-hmm. What did you refer to in that? What are these companies putting in?
They're chemicals that enhance the flavors. They're chemicals that enhance the flavors and the experience of, you know, the mouthfeel and the the stimulation of the pleasure centers.
So is that referred to? It excites the nervous system, like it gets you upregulate something.
Yeah. Yeah.
What would be something we would see on a label that does that? Do you know?
I've been advised not to say.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
So
you worked in that industry that was.
Yeah. And in all fairness, I don't want to misrepresent myself. I didn't work exhaustively with the research and development team. I knew what was in the bars. So I knew what was happening. I worked more with the advertising. With the advertising systems. Yeah, but I work with those companies. We talk to consumers about the advertising and we help the companies figure out how to change the packaging or, you know, change the spokespeople or change what they were saying to make people feel like this is where the good stuff was. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I'm sorry for not being able to answer that.
No, it's okay.
Directly. Yeah.
It's fine. So you were talking about the plausible. So their advertising tries to present a message that makes people give themselves a reason to like justify whatever the.
People want good news about their bad habits is what it comes down to. and the advertising industry is very happy to give you good news about your bad habits. Some reason why you can go forward with that. But I mean, from my personal journey, it made it clear to me that this also had nothing to do with my history or my emotional traumas or anything like that. And so I came to the conclusion that what I really needed to do was take control, that it was more like an alpha wolf project, the alpha wolf of my own mind. And when you look at what an alpha wolf does in the wild, if it's challenged for leadership, it doesn't say, oh my goodness, someone needs a hug. It growls and it snarls and it says, get back in line or I'll kill you, right? It asserts its superiority. And that's what I did. I'd also read some alternative addiction treatment literature that I got some of these ideas from, where when people were stopping drinking, one way that they could stop drinking was to bifurcate their mind and recognize that they had thoughts that said that they should drink and thoughts that said that they shouldn't drink. And if you could make a declaration that you weren't going to drink, then you would wake up and recognize that you had these thoughts that suggested that you should, and then you could deal with those thoughts. So I adopted that idea, and I did something kind of embarrassing. And I wasn't planning on teaching this. Remember, I was a child and family psychologist, and I was never planning to work with overeaters. I was just trying to fix this for myself. But I decided that I was going to call this thing, I was going to have to know when this was awake if I wanted to deal with it, I was going to call this thing my inner pick. And
for the listeners, you're holding your hand up to representing the as you say it, the reptilian part of the brain.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's the part of our brain that has the ability to push our rational mind aside when it perceives there to be a scarce caloric opportunity or a falsely perceived emergency. I decided I had to know when that was active. And so I like this idea of bifurcating the mind into two types of thoughts. So I made a rule. One of my first rules was I'll never have chocolate on a weekday again. I'll only ever have it on the weekends and no more than 2 ounces. With that rule in place, it functioned kind of like a tripwire, so that if I was at a coffee shop and there was a chocolate bar on the counter as I was waiting to pay for my latte, and I heard this little voice in my head that said, go ahead, it'll be just as easy to start your silly diet again tomorrow, I would say, wait a minute, that's not me. That's my inner pig, and it's squealing for pig slop. Chocolate on a Wednesday is pig slop. I don't eat pig slop. I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. It sounds ridiculous and crude. I could have just called it a food monster. I didn't have to use the word pig, but that's what I did. And I know now that what it did was it opened up a space between stimulus and response. It took this automated habit loop, and it gave me a second to just pause, be a little bit more mindful. It wasn't a miracle. I didn't get better right away. But I did have those extra microseconds between stimulus and response to make the right choice if I wanted to. And over time, I experimented with different things I could do with that space. I figured out ways to make it a little bit broader. One of the things that I did, the biggest thing I did over the first several years that I recovered, was to logically disempower what my pig was saying. So the pig would say, it'll be just as easy to start your diet again tomorrow. Well, the truth is, it's not. Because of the principle of neuroplasticity, what fires together, wires together. So if I have a craving for chocolate and I have the thought, I'll just start again tomorrow, and then I eat the chocolate, I will have reinforced both the craving and the thought, so that tomorrow I'm going to have a deeper craving for chocolate and going to be more likely to say, just start tomorrow. And this is why things snowball downhill. So you can only ever use the present moment to be healthy. And if you're in a hole, you got to stop digging. That's an example of what I'd call a rational refutation, or fixing your thinking about food, taking away your excuses. And when you take away your excuses, it creates a type of cognitive dissonance, a psychological discomfort with observing yourself about to break your own most, you know, solemn commitments. That worked for me. Not all the time, not 100% of the time, but it really worked for me. And over the course of many years, I kept a journal about all the crazy things my pig said and why it was wrong. And I was able to get thin, largely doing that. When I was about...
So would you, do you attribute the getting the losing weight to basically just eating less food, because you weren't eating these hyper palatable favorite things like chocolate or pizza? Or,
well, I would still eat some of them. I would have conditional rules where I would say I'd only have it on the weekend or only twice a week. So I didn't just give up everything. Chocolate, I eventually gravitated towards not eating at all. I got thin because I was not allowing my whims and emotions and impulses to control my most important food choices. I move those food choices to my intellect. So I could say I'm going to have 2 ounces of chocolate on a Saturday, or I could say I'm going to have a slice of pizza twice a week. And I develop the ability to comply with that as opposed to, oh, well, what the hell? I guess I'm binging now. I might as well eat 5,000 calories today and eat everything else that I want because tomorrow I'm going to be better. So, you know, I mean, there were other things that I did. I also, I evened out my nutrition. I discovered that it was easier to deal with the chocolate cravings. They were much less intense if I was having these kale banana smoothies. There's something in the kale and banana that I must have been missing that I was looking for in the chocolate. I don't know if it was the energy or magnesium or exactly what it was, but I evened out my nutrition. I stopped skipping meals. I moved more and more towards whole foods and less and less towards less and more away from processed foods. That's why I got thin. When I worked with clients, and you know, my books have had more than 2 million readers at this point, and you know, I've worked with over 2,000 people, and I've had 10 coaches that are working with me, so I've got an awful lot of experience seeing what works and what doesn't. What I found in the last couple of years when we started to do long-term surveys was that while we'd gotten very good at fixing people's thinking about food and getting them to reduce their self-reported overeating episodes by almost 90% in 1 month, at the six-month mark, the stats weren't that good. It was more like 50, 55%, something like that. And when I looked carefully into that, I found that there were two types of people. There were people who were still doing reasonably well, like maybe around 80%, and there were people who were doing horribly who had just abandoned the tools that I taught them. What was causing them to abandon it turned out to be what I'd call the screw it, just do it response. Inevitably, those people seemed to get to a point where they said, you know what? I don't have any more excuses to overeat, but oh, well, what the hell? I really want to. Screw it, just do it. And I said, well, what's causing that? Because remember, my program is diet agnostic. You can plan out to eat whatever you want to. I don't take any particular food away from anybody. You don't have to eat a certain number of calories. You can decide what you really want to do best. So I thought, well, why would people abandon these tools where they can eat the foods that they really want to, get themselves to a weight that they want to be at, feel a lot more at peace with food? So I was really, really curious about this. And it turns out, and this probably is where the overlap in your field of expertise really comes, it has to do with what I would call organismic distress. There are five or six things that seem to lead to this organismic distress. But basically, it's a perceived emergency on the lower brain's part, which says, holy crap, we need more resources. There's no time to think. We have to get it. This could be something as simple as skipping meals, eating a lot of junk, not eating things to keep your glycemic level a little more even. It could also be things like becoming too tired, not having enough water, not really valuing the experience of eating mindfully. When people that have gotten very involved in binging and overeating, they frequently have allowed the automatic nature of that. See, the body wants to automate calorie acquisition. And so this is why you pass the donut store sign, and before you know it, you're in the parking lot, you know, with a bag of donuts half eaten in your mouth already. It's because your brain doesn't want you to have to think about the habits that you've learned to acquire calories. So it's very, very likely.
What do you mean? Hold on. Can I stop you there? Your brain, you're saying your brain doesn't want to have to think about the habits that you acquire calories from. Why do you say that? What does that mean?
Well,
why is it a problem to think about how you're going to get food?
Well, it's a good idea to think about how you're going to get food. But we're not really programmed to do that. Because 100,000 years ago, food was pretty scarce. And so the brain learned that it was a survival advantage whenever it could identify a food cue and have that, you know, food cue lead to the acquisition of calories more or less automatically, because it had to do a lot of work to find these things, and you needed to be working really hard all the time to find additional food cues. So if a caveman 100,000 years ago, let's call him Thag, because I like the name, T-H-A-G, and he saw a monkey that led him to a banana tree, after doing that once or twice and gorging himself on bananas, it would become a kind of automatic behavior.
To just follow a monkey?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't even think about it. He would know, you know, he would get excited. He'd actually kind of be happy while he was following the monkey, because the brain would secrete dopamine to make him happy. If he didn't follow the monkey, the brain would deplete his dopamine to make him miserable, saying, I'm going to torture you unless you follow that monkey and go get those bananas. Because it was a survival advantage. You had to take advantage of every food cue that there was without thinking about it. You couldn't sit back and think, well, maybe I should go, you know, look for that honeybee over there. Or maybe I should, no, this monkeys lead to bananas, go follow that monkey, right? That's why it becomes type of a kind of automated behavior. Does that make sense? Or it looks like I'm not.
I mean, a little bit. My mind is definitely, in my mind, I'm pushing back. I like when I hear that, I think of the monkey has way more calories than the banana. Wouldn't they be thinking about how am I going to get the monkey once I find the bananas and have my monkey and my banana for dessert? And which would mean you'd have to think about how you're going to catch a monkey, which is, I would say, filled with thought. I guess I understand you're getting at that once we find a way that allows us to get calories, essentially our subconscious mind will help take care of us by ingraining that habit that allows calories to come easily. So like we will automatically follow where we know there's calories at the other end. We don't have to consider, should I follow it?
Yeah.
Just follow.
That's absolutely true. I suppose that's a good challenge to this metaphor. I suppose the metaphor might break down there, because the monkey would have more calories if you could catch and kill the monkey and eat the monkey. You could use a cue like the particular type of banana tree leaf waving in the wind or something like that. And I would still make the point. And then your brain would automatically go say, okay, go find that tree and go get the bananas. Or it could be following a honeybee to a honeycomb. But there are cues that lead to the acquisition of calories. Just like in the modern food environment, the donut store sign tells you that the donuts are available. Right. Inside for all, not that much effort. And so the brain wants to automate that. It's just, it's more efficient. It ensured our survival a long time ago. It doesn't serve a good function in the modern food environment, because I could walk downstairs for $100, buy 10,000 calories at the convenience store, and walk across the street to the other convenience store and do it again. So.
Right. But if I have high quality, nourishing, health supporting food in my fridge, and I walk downstairs and I subconsciously am used to just wandering through the kitchen and open the fridge and grabbing some of that food. Like, we do need to eat. So I need that food to provide structure and energy and such. It's not all bad that it gets automated, that I remember to go into the kitchen to get it. So I don't, otherwise I would skip the meal.
But that's exactly what you're kind of making the point for me. That the problem is that when the industry has...
they're working against you.
When they're working against you, when they're using our tendency to automate things like that to get you to have what's in the bags and boxes and containers, that's a problem.
Right.
Yeah. And also, it's not a bad idea to slow down while you're eating. Anyway, for sure. I mean, there are studies that say we absorb more of the nutrition, we get more satisfaction, we wind up eating less if we're actually present while we're eating, and it's not such an automatic behavior. So I would want people to do both. I'd want them to automate healthy behaviors and try to slow down and mindfully enjoy the food while they're eating it, and also be alert for the fact that the industry could use that against you.
Yeah, so that's something I think I personally have struggled with a lot over the years. And I know that it's better to go slow and to chew, and you'll produce more enzymes to help digest your food and such, and get more signaling for the whole GI tract to do what it does best. One thing that I feel like affects me negatively in that regard is I do most of the cooking, and I love to cook, and I get a lot of joy out of cooking dinner for my family. And we value dinner time in my household pretty highly. And but cooking is a lot of, it's like an art of timing in many ways, where if you have, especially if you have multiple things going on, the goal is to get everything to finish at the same time. Mm-hmm. And what that leads to is a little bit of chaos sometimes in the cooking process. Like if you ever watch a cook in a restaurant that's, you know, really moving a lot of things at once, it can be a stressful activity because it's fast and you're moving around and your mind is very busy coordinating all the parts. And then what happens is I call dinner and everything's done and I want to eat it when it's warm, and I put it on and I'm racy from the actual activity cooking. And it doesn't really happen when I'm just cooking for myself. I'm cooking one simple thing. But if I'm making dinner for five people, there's a lot more going on. And then I sit down and everybody else gets to relax. They're coming from a relaxed state and moseying on over to the kitchen table when I call dinner. But I'm just sitting down from this, like, you know, I'm running around like crazy, especially if I'm cooking like something on the grill and I'm going back and forth in from the kitchen outside, back and forth. And then I like sit down and I'm excited. Mm-hmm. And then I want to do this parasympathetic activity of eating. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to slow myself down.
It is. It's a real challenge. It is a challenge, and it's a muscle. You think of it like a mental muscle. And so I would have people begin very slowly. You know, you don't have to jump in and be totally mindful the whole time that you're eating from the very get-go. At the beginning, you could just begin to work on your pause muscle by going 1, 2, 3, something just really simple like that, and do that for a couple of weeks until you get used to it. And you'll find the experience of those first few bites will be more pleasurable when you do that. And that will help reinforce your desire to do that, even though it doesn't seem natural. And then once you're comfortable with that, you can take a parasympathetic breath. So you'd go 1, 2, 3, and then you could breathe in for a count of 7, and you could breathe out for a count of 11. That starts to deactivate the sympathetic nervous system and take you into the part of the brain that says it's okay to relax and chill and digest and rest. So you can build up that muscle very slowly. I think the way we got into this conversation was I was trying to explain that the screw it, just do it response is underlied by a sense of organismic distress. One part of that experience of organismic distress is I have to eat right now. It's an emergency that I eat right now. So if you work on that, and this is the hardest part to slow down, but if you work on that and you start to slow that down, then you're going to get more satisfaction from the food, and there's going to be less of a craving to overeat and just, you know, break your rules at a different time. You know, that there are other things like having too much input and too many decisions to make over the course of a day. Willpower is just the ability to make good decisions at the moment of temptation. And there are only so many good ones we can make over the course of a day. And so we find that if we can get people to step out of the rat race twice a day for 5 minutes, it doesn't have to be a big deal, but turn off your phone, turn off your computer, go hide in the bathroom if you have to, get away from all the input. It's not just food decisions that'll wear down your willpower. It's what do I do with this email? What time is the meeting? Who's going to take Jenny to soccer practice? Step away from all of that twice a day. And you begin to reduce that organismic distress, and you'll find you'll have just a little more willpower. Coming up with rules to regulate your difficult food decisions can also remove the need to make so many decisions over the course of the day. You know, we're told to eat well 90% of the time and indulge 10% of the time, which is great in theory. It's actually a really good idea, but how do you know which is the 90% and which is the 10%? Whereas if I say I'm only going to have chocolate on Saturdays, then all of my chocolate decisions were made for me over the course of the week. I don't have to burn willpower to make those decisions. I just become the kind of person that doesn't have chocolate during the week. So, you know, it's all these kinds of things. It's too much social isolation. It's, you know, being overworked, fatigued, all of the organismic distress, which is the opposite of being able to be relaxed and mindful. That also played a role, and that's how we're beginning to correct the Scourge Stewart response, which was plaguing us up until that point. And then the other part of the new book had to do with understanding the extinction curve, because people think that it goes down in a straight line. If you decide you're going to stop having donuts on the way home from work, that your cravings are just going to go down like that, but that's not really how it works. It goes a little bit of a honeymoon period and then a gigantic burst of cravings, and then it starts to go down. Just knowing that, you can be prepared for it, because most people get to this burst and they think, I must be doing something wrong. This is torturous. It's going to be torturous forever. And they give up and they reinforce the craving again at that point. And that's the worst thing you could do, because you've told your brain that the reward is available intermittently now. So it's going to try even harder. Because imagine Thag and the banana trees, and just, if you can live with my monkey metaphor for the moment.
Sure.
Eventually, the season would wear on, and the bananas wouldn't be available every time you followed a monkey. But it would still be in Thag's best interest to follow monkeys that led him to trees 50% of the time, as opposed to having no cue to find food at all. So the brain would work even harder to motivate him and make him even more miserable if the food were not forthcoming, if he didn't follow the monkey. So for this reason, the brain goes crazy when you start to take away the previous learning. So previously the brain thought a monkey always leads to a banana tree. Now it goes, you know, where the F are my bananas? It goes kind of nuts. And you got to power through that. You have to expect that to be available. And if you want to keep on eating something, you need to bind it to a specific context, because the brain will learn complex food cues. It doesn't have to just be, you know, I eat a donut whenever I pass the donut store. It could be I eat a donut only on Saturdays after a workout when I pass the donut store. And the brain will learn that eventually, just like if you had a slot machine in Las Vegas that only paid off on Saturday morning at 10:30, your brain would eventually learn it. It wouldn't bother going to the casino during the week. But when the reward is available intermittently, if you don't know when it's going to pay off, that's when you get those little old ladies at the slot machines that just won't leave, because you got to be there when the machine pays off, right? So you can go through an extinction curve by teaching your brain that a food is only available in a particular context or at a particular time. And that will work as well for 2 out of 3 people as giving up that food entirely. So
this is all modality that you're using, say, is really driven around tinkering with the psychology, trying to control your psychology, not so much around the nutrition itself.
Well, I find Margaret Mead said it's easier to get someone to change their religion than to change their diet. So I've worked really hard to find ways to get people to stop binging on whatever diet they wanted to work on. That said, you know, your biology will overtake your psychology if you're not attending to your authentic biological needs. I could say, I could try to make a rule that says I will never pee again, and I could use all these tools and be more mindful. But in about 6 to 12 hours, and maybe sooner because I'm almost 60, my bladder would tell me otherwise, right? Similarly, you could say I'm only going to have 500 calories a day, but there's only so long you can do that before your, you know, authentic hunger is going to overtake you. You know, I've had people say, well, I'm only going to have donuts, or I'm only going to have potatoes or something like that. With the extreme diets, we wind up getting about half the success rate as we do when people have a more balanced approach. It's less important whether they're vegetarian or meat eating or point counting or calorie counting. It's more important that it's regular, reliable, and it's, you know, if you go over to some of the nutritional calculators or you meet with a dietitian to be sure that your nutritional needs really are being fulfilled, then, you know, we can have 2 or 3 times the success rate when people really properly nutrify themselves. So I'm not a dietitian. I'm not a medical doctor. So I don't really have the authority to say, eat this. If I could, I would say, eat as little processed food as you can, eat as regularly, reliably as you can, flood your body with nutrition at a slight caloric deficit. It's going to be 10 times easier to stop binging on that kind of a diet than some people want me to help them stop binging while they have marshmallows all day. And I just, I can't really help them. So
it's really, your work's really geared around weight loss though. Like you, when you say at a slight caloric deficit, you're generally working with people that are trying to lose weight. That's the primary goal.
Usually the tagline of the book is defeat your cravings, the back door to weight loss. The reason I call it that is because I've paradoxically found that if you focus on weight loss, you create that organismic distress. Oh my God, I've got this wedding coming up. I've got to lose 30 pounds in 30 days. The brain perceives that as an emergency also. And that's more likely to create the screw it, just do it response. So I tell people to really focus on learning that they can eat what they say they're going to eat, learning to keep their word to themselves, and then slowly adjusting their plan to lose weight if that's what they want to do. Most of our people lose some weight. Some of our people lose hundreds of pounds. We have very good typical results like that, but it's not my first goal. And I try to get people not to focus on that too much.
Gotcha. And you do this on a one-on-one basis, or what's the setting that you practice?
I mean, we have a variety of different programs available, but the main program is 90 days. There is a daily live support group in a Zoom-like environment, like in an online environment. And then you get calls with your individual coach for 15 minutes at a time, as needed, with a minimum of 5 days in between, as long as you and your coach kind of agree what you're going to do in between.
So it's a group setting online with a daily group meeting, basically.
Yeah, you don't have to come to all the groups, but they're kind of like office hours where myself and my coaches are available to coach people in that group environment to just answer their questions. I don't do treatment anymore. I offer this as training and education. You know, it's just a little bit safer. And I don't necessarily 100% agree with all the standards of care of practice in my profession. So this way I'm free to educate people on what I think is best. And
when you say you don't do treatment, you mean like psych as a...
Yeah. So if you have a diagnosable DSM-5, eating disorder, then a lot of people come to my program do have that, but we require that they also have a doctor's permission to take this as...
What did you just say? DSM-5? I've never heard that. What does that mean?
Oh, it's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of like the code book of the mental health profession.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. Anorexia, bulimia. Or binge eating disorder, when you're diagnosed with those types of things, then legally I need you to have another professional that's saying it's okay to do this with us.
Binge eating disorder. That's a thing. So is there a nutritionist or a dietitian involved in the group at all, or it's...
We highly recommend that people consult with a dietitian or nutritionist in order to validate that what they're eating is an appropriate, you know, protocol for who they are and what they need to. We, you know, I don't have the expertise to evaluate and, you know, and offer dietary advice. I don't have that expertise. Gotcha. So, I kind of sort of do because of all the people I've talked to, and I've interviewed a lot of nutritionists for my own podcast. And there are a couple of people I might recommend if people needed someone, but,
Name of your podcast, Glenn? I don't think
Defeat Your Cravings.
Okay. That's the name of the podcast.
Yeah. Defeat Your Cravings. Yeah.
And you wrote a couple books, and you mentioned something about a free book that you have available.
Yeah, if you go to defeatyourcravings.com and you click the big blue button and sign up for the reader bonus list, I will give you a free copy of the book itself in Kindle, Nook, or PDF format. If you want a traditional format like paperback or hardcover or Audible, there are traditional charges for that, but you can get it for free in Kindle, Nook, or PDF. This is all laid out step by step in that book. I also have a set of food plan starter templates. These are sample templates of what people might use depending upon their dietary philosophy. So there's one for keto, there's one for point counters, calorie counters, there's one for vegetarians. It's, you know,
so your approach works across that spectrum. So if somebody comes in and they want to be on a ketogenic diet, or they want to eat as much meat as possible or as much vegetables as possible, like, it doesn't really matter. You're really working on how to think about what's drawing you to eat,
what's making you want to break the rules. The more extreme the diet on both, on any side of the spectrum, the harder it is to do. So people that are 100% raw vegan and want to live on only fruit and leafy greens, it's a little harder to do that than if they're just plain vegetarian and, you know, eating.
Yeah, my guess would be because they're just malnourished. I mean, I don't know if you could really be properly nourished without any animal product.
Well, I mean, I think that's debatable. I try to stay out of that debate.
Gotcha.
I have other people who only eat animal products, and I have a little harder time with them also, like people who won't have any vegetables whatsoever.
Harder time because they have trouble sticking to that. I feel, in my experience, I've heard when people do that, their cravings naturally go down because the blood sugar gets so kind of stable.
Yeah. They usually tend to break with carbs. They eventually break with carbs. If I can get them to add some greens or, I mean, again, I'm not a dietitian, so this is really not my place to say, but I can just tell you my experience with all the people we work with, that if they're only eating meat and I can get them to have, you know, some greens or a couple of carrots here or there, that they tend to do better. Nothing that's going to take them out of ketosis.
Yeah, I find I've done a lot of different diets over the years, and I also used to be really heavy, and then I've had some big swings. I went from 237 and I got down to at one point 153, which was from too heavy to too light. Mm-hmm. And I've been tinkering with different numbers in between now, trying to find, you know, what's works best for me. But because that feels like there's pros and cons of being 175, and there's pros and cons of being 210. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to find the balance point. What's that?
Well, sometimes the juice ain't worth the squeeze. Like, if you're medically okay and your blood levels are okay and your doctor's okay with you, sometimes it's just not worth the energy and effort and everything you have to do to, you know, maintain 11% body fat. It's just...
I don't even know what's good. Like, I don't know if we really know what the optimal body fat is. I mean, I have come to the belief, I guess, that, and, you know, I'm not a doctor, but I've been studying health for a long time. I think that it's healthier to probably have 10 pounds of excess weight, even in the form of fat, than an ounce not enough. I think by definition, being underweight by any amount, you are putting your body in a position, you're putting the inner wisdom that's running the show or whatever, to a choice that it needs to make to divert resources away from something that it would prefer to have resources for. Mm-hmm. And I think there's value in having a sense of abundance. Mm-hmm. And that's why I also think it's useful to, granted, it's obviously useful to use strategies, you know, and your strategies sound could be potentially great for people to eliminate some of these, like, especially these processed foods that are kind of permeating through our whole culture and society, but to also embrace the awesomeness of eating and the abundance that it can provide. Like, I found a diet that kind of works for me, and I got it to a point where I love every single meal. Like, I just love all the foods I get to eat. So,
and we're supposed to.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah. And that works. And I do find with my clients, you know, the look on their eyes when I tell them they could eat some of their favorite foods, and I recommend it. I mean, it means something, because we are pushed a lot of information in the health sphere of things that are just bad and to cut this and to cut that. And it's like, we're not often said, like, your body needs these things to do what it wants to do. So you get to eat these things. Like, you get to, like, it's a privilege. It's, you know, it's something to celebrate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
but yeah, that I've tinkered with more restrictive diets, though, and sometimes they were out of just, I wasn't feeling good. My health wasn't good. And I was trying to figure out what, and I knew there was a dietary component, and it was really a tough puzzle for me. And I'd get really restrictive, and it wasn't fun. And it was hard to stick to. And it was probably hard to stick to because I wasn't getting something I needed. And my body was trying to tell me, and I didn't really know, even though I could hear it, I didn't know how to listen to those signals from my body. Like, those hyperpalatable foods, people like them because, you know, you say they got fat and sugar. Well, fat and sugar are things we need.
Yep.
Like, our body runs on sugar.
Yep.
As its primary fuel source, glucose. Yep. So, yep. Like, of course we're going to crave it.
Right.
And it's unfortunate that the industry on the other side of that wall, as you say, whatever, you know, they don't wake up and start their day thinking, how can I help Glenn optimize his health, when we're putting these foods together in a lab? They have different incentives.
Yeah. Yeah, they sure do. Yeah. Yeah, they do. Now, the other thing that I've come to in my old age that I didn't really believe before, was that if the only thing that you optimize for is health, then that's all you're going to have. Like, there was a time that I used to have my food plan cleaner than it is now, like with less. So, I mean, I really enjoy, you know, whole fruits and vegetables and you know, beans and greens and all of my whole foods. I really love them. But I also have a couple of things that I probably pay a small health price for having that. But I consciously and purposely do that because I want that enjoyment. And I don't want to live to 120 years old while all of my friends die or become, you know, disabled. I'm okay. If I can hike in my 90s, I think I'm okay.
Sounds like a win. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like a win. You know, that's a win to me. So we all, I think there's a continuum from live fast and die young, like the Hells Angels, and, you know, live slower and enjoy the ride. It's a continuum, and everybody has to choose where along that continuum they fall, what they want to do, what consequences and trade-offs they want to take. And I don't think it keeps you out of heaven to eat some delicious things and compromise your health a little bit if you really want to. I don't. So, I mean, that sounds almost sacrilegious for a health professional to say, but that's what I've come to believe in my long run. And, you know, that last, to your point before, I was dating a woman who's, she's a little bit underweight, and she got COVID, and, you know, the doctors were terrified that they're gonna have to put her in the hospital because she didn't have the weight to sustain it. She couldn't eat that much for a couple of weeks, and she was getting thinner and thinner and thinner. And I think we need a little bit of excess for those types of situations. And so the idea that we should be obsessed with maintaining the ideal body weight, you know, as thin as possible, I just think it's a little bit dangerous these days. So yeah, I'm just supporting what you're saying.
Yeah, I have a client that's from Colombia, South America, and she said that if in her community, if there was somebody that you could like see their abdominal muscles, the community would be concerned. Like everybody would start bringing that person food. Like the older cultures didn't look at the leanness that our magazines show as a sign of health. It was more a sign of like scarcity and potentially disease. And it's interesting to experiment with the body and get familiar and tinker with the control dials. And I've gotten pretty lean at some point where all those muscles show. And I don't know if it's necessarily better. And I really am skeptical of whether we as a society really know what's optimal. I'm like, what allows you to do all the things you want to do and feel good as you do it is probably the optimal like physiology for you. Like if you could get up and nothing really impedes with your ability to do what you want to do and you feel good all the way, then you're probably doing something right. And there's
And consult with your doctor and see if there are any major risks that you're taking, and weigh that into the equation. But ultimately, it's our decision.
Well, I haven't been impressed by doctors in general, their opinions of food. And I think it stems from, I don't think that's their primary, well, I know it's not their primary training, but it seems like the food aspect, they're somewhat limited because as a percentage of their education, it's fairly small these days. And, that might vary from medical school to medical school, but that's something I've heard directly from doctors in the past where I'll be working with them and I'll be shedding some insights that they seem valuable, and they come to that recognition that even though it's funny too, because if you get into like the bioenergetics and the real relationship of like nutrition to physiology, and you talk about certain pathways like how we make energy as such, they'll recognize that in school they had to memorize all the points of the pathway. And maybe even memorize all the cofactors needed to get from step A to step B and so forth. But they weren't taught how that relates to feeling good.
That's interesting.
Because that's not really that medical model. And the medical model can work wonders and do miracles in so many contexts. But for what a lot of people deal with these like kind of chronic conditions because of lifestyle-based thing, that model is somewhat handcuffed because it doesn't have the best toolkit for those problems. It has great toolkits for other problems, especially acute situations, like you got hit by a car and you're on the street and one of your organs is lying next to you on the street and you need someone to put that back in.
I'd rather that was a medical doctor.
Yeah, for sure.
At that point,
Like they're very well equipped for these amazing acute scenarios.
But to know what to eat to recover from that's a different story.
Yeah, and they generally don't have enough time to get enough information with the patient and to delve in and to educate. So it's a different model. But there's a lot of people waking up to that, and there's more people educating. And now with the flow of information, it's easier if you're interested and you want to take more control and play a bigger role in your sense of well-being. You can go out there and listen to podcasts of nutritionists or people like you, or read books or go on YouTube, and you could find information and find what's best for you. Glenn, I want to thank you for taking the time today. Defeat your craving. Is that the website? Did I say
Defeat Your Cravings, plural.
Okay. Defeatyourcravings.com.
Yes, please.
Okay. And for the listeners out there, I appreciate your listening as always. And if you feel like you know somebody that could benefit them, this conversation, please share it and check out Glenn's work. Glenn, thanks again for joining me.
Thanks so much, Les.